Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Insurers The Best Policy podcast. My name is David Bull and today I am again joined by Mike Sapner, CEO of Reinsurer Trans Re, for the second instalment of our two-part interview. We discuss property cat and the impact of what's happening in the ILS market, as well as strategic capital relationships. Mike will also give his view on the insurability of pandemics, public-private solutions, and the read across from COVID-19 to systemic cyber exposures. And we'll talk about the industry's diversity issue and how companies can address it. We start by asking Mike how collateral lockup is impacting property cat dynamics in the build-up to 1-1.
You know, the locked-up ILS capital has been somewhat problematic for people's balance sheets. The interesting thing, David, we talked about a hard market. If you went through the annual reports of the publicly traded reinsurers, you'll see that their peak zone exposure is not anywhere near their tolerances, right? They're not running at max tolerance. So they have the ability to go out and write more business against equity if the pricing is adequate enough. So I think what people are telling you is this is the amount we're willing to take at this pricing. And once ILS gets locked up or if it's not available, you're going to see pricing significantly increase because it's got to meet my equity returns, not some fixed income diversified pension fund returns. So the extent that new ILS capital replaces it, or to the extent that capital remains trapped, you will see a differentiation in pricing as it stays on people's balance sheets because there's different hurdle rates. And I think that's mostly in peak zones. Non-peak zones, which tend to be diversifiers for the balance sheet, typically have run at lower pricing, higher expected combined ratios, maybe to our detriment, probably too aggressively priced for its diversification benefit, but not really attractive to ILS capital because of the pricing. That should tell us something. But attractive to balance sheets because of the capital diversification benefit. As peak zones go up, perhaps those non-peak zone pricing or diversification becomes more important on one level, but as it shrinks as the overall portfolio, the benefit becomes less and therefore could wind up requiring price increase. So I think that ILS is a big indicator or a big determinant on what the balance sheet pricing is going to be. The one thing that bothers me, I think, is that ILS capital doesn't own its own balance sheet in most cases. Now, Nephila has gone and was purchased by Markel. I think that was a step in acknowledgement that that's the one thing that can crush ILS is that if no one gives them the leverage or the balance sheet, the evergreen promise to pay, their product is not a great substitute. And we've seen that time and again, and we see it right now. So we've kind of cut our own throats and underpriced the leverage that we're giving these funds to our own detriment. And I think that all has to be recalibrated, rebalanced, and redetermined, especially if ILS is going to be close to a majority of the capital behind the cat risk. If ILS is 10% of my capital and I give them leverage and I blow through the top of the program, I'm probably sunk anyway because 90% of my portfolio would be at such an extreme loss event that I'm insolvent. But if it's 50% of my capital or 60% or 80%, maybe I would be in business on just the business I've kept net. And that tail risk could actually be enough to put me out of business. And what is the price for that? Now, it's been, you know, we need to be paid better for our distribution and leverage, and that's not happening. So I think we're in a whole period of time where that price discovery is going on.
And your parent Allegheny CEO Weston Hicks talked earlier this year about you guys developing new strategic capital relationships, and I'm just interested in how that sort of manifested itself so far, and maybe if you can talk a bit about your partnership with Integral ILS, which was sort of recently emerged as a startup in the kind of fund space.
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, you have to remember that we have Gen Re as a partner where we authorize, so we have a balance sheet partner. We have Pillar, who we own a significant percentage of the GP, and we're invested in their funds. And Pillar, you know, for a long period of time, being offshore, we were onshore. There are certain restrictions on what we could do from servicing. They've built a great business with this. Steve Velotti's built an outstanding track record. So we've chosen to remain completely disconnected from a servicing standpoint and from giving business to Pillar. We're just an investor and an owner, and Steve runs that business, so that's worked out great. So that really meant we didn't have a strategic partner as respects our own portfolio of business. And so we entered this partnership with Integral as a way to mutually optimize our portfolios, right? We have a distribution network and a bunch of risk on our balance sheet, and they're going to have capital and a portfolio they have to build. And we think there are ways to optimize our respective needs for our respective capital bases, but for us to also get some compensation for the services and the portfolio construction we're providing. You know, that is wholly different than we're not investing in their funds. You know, we're not controlling GPs. We're not sitting on boards. That's not, it's a different deal. And you kind of see this where you've got aligned capital, non-aligned capital, and then kind of integrated capital, like an AlphaCat integrated with AIG. And then you've got situations where Hanover just fronts for people, Arch just fronts for people, where they have no investment in the funds or the GP, right? So we kind of have a situation where in one case we have an investment in the GP and an investment in the funds, and in the other case we're providing services which we think will be mutually beneficial. Kind of the differences between the funds, and look, I think you have to make yourself available in all parts of the spectrum if you're a reinsurance company. We're really just a reinsurance company, so we wanted to play in all spaces. You know, and Lushin and Zhang and Richard Lothar have long-standing track record in the marketplace. We think they're quality people and good underwriters, good investors.
And just jumping around a little bit, but in our kind of conversation about costs and the, I suppose the industry value chain, also distribution is part of that that chain, particularly in terms of your distribution. I mean, we're looking at kind of large scale consolidation over the last couple of years. And I just wanted to, I guess, get your view on, as a reinsurer, is it positive or a negative if the big three reinsurance brokers become the bigger two reinsurance brokers? Yeah.
You know, I think that in the long run, I'm probably indifferent. It's hard to say it's better, but, you know, it makes McGill and Partners, Tiger Risk, BMS, Beach, a lot of the independent smaller brokers who are very creative or hustlers who are been attracting talent, you know, makes them more viable in some ways and more of an interesting alternative. So then I think, you know, an oligopoly sometimes is worse than a monopoly. So maybe the two will merge and we can get a fixed brokerage that we know that everyone, it's standardized and it's at a reasonable amount. I say that a little tongue in cheek, obviously. But I do think an interesting thing here is that you're getting down to a choice of two. And these brokers feel that they are really the client advocates. At what point does it move to a fee-based client decides what the value of those services are and let them pay it and take it out of the reinsurance transaction costs?
Yeah.
And look, for me, the broker market is a great model. I have a variable cost for my distribution. If I write more, I pay more. If I write less, I pay less. And a big problem with our business is, you know, managing volume against fixed cost. And people chase the top line because they don't want to cut the expense line. You know, we pay about 4%. So for us, that's around $160, $170 million to run a distribution. That's probably fairly reasonable. If we write $10 billion, should it be $400 million? Look, if it's profitable business, I guess there's nothing wrong with that. The thing is what's the right amount of brokerage? Who's really paying the brokerage? Are you overpaid on excess of loss, underpaid on quota share? You know, we keep hearing market brokerage. What is market brokerage? When I came into the market, you know, it was 1.5% on gross, 2% on net. Now everyone thinks the standard is 2.5 on gross. I don't know when that became the market brokerage, right? I don't know when that was decided and who decided it. But what I will tell you now that's kind of interesting is there's non-concurrency going on all over the place.
Yeah.
In terms of pricing and distribution costs. And when I say distribution costs, not concurrency, up and down, right? There's people paying kickers and additional commissions for productivity and vice versa, structured in all sorts of different ways. And generally disclosed. I don't think it's an issue. I'm just saying that the value of paper and distribution means different things to different people. And I know I won't decide it as a $5 billion company. It won't be up to me, right? The market's going to have to decide. Clients will have to decide. And I think there are both positive and negatives that come out from consolidation. So short run, probably worse for me. Long run, I'm not sure. Sure. We'll see.
And then we're beginning to run out of time, but I just wanted to touch on a few more issues. One is kind of looking back at COVID-19, and we talked about a little bit about aggregation more generally. You know, are we, as an industry, are reinsurers getting paid enough for this, assuming? And what do you think the lessons are about aggregation and, you know, unmodeled exposures that come from COVID-19? It seems like after every kind of major event, there's some kind of a lesson, but this is one that obviously is a bit different from most of the kind of natural catastrophe events we see.
So that's a good question. I think first thing is this was not an unknown exposure, right? It was on, as Vijay Dowling likes to point out, it was on the cover of Time magazine 4 times in 20 years.
Right.
And we had exclusions and policies for it. So I don't think it was well underwritten in some cases, and I don't think the aggregations were fully appreciated in terms of government shutdowns. We had pandemic as one of our extreme events. We ran it in our ORSA, so it was known. I think what's interesting to extrapolate, though, is something towards cyber, right? If you ever wanted to know what a systemic cyber loss would feel like, this is it, and you wouldn't be able to work from home. So I think what it should point to immediately is people should be thinking about, are we really properly underwriting our cyber risk when we're giving business interruption and contingent business interruption in policies and the systemic implications from that? I think the other thing is a good reminder that at the tail, everything is correlated, right?
Right.
And so investments, property, casualty, workers' comp, med mal, D&L, right? It's all correlated at tail. So that's something that needs to be thought about. So, you know, I'm often asked, is it insurable? And to be honest with you, it's not insurable, because insurance and reinsurance basically goes on the premise of law of large numbers, diversification, not everyone's going to have a claim at the same time. And you look at the capital of the industry versus the economic losses of the economy, it's just, you know, we're a very small part of it all. And it seems to me that you'd be better off, rather than, and I know Chubb's put out pandemic, public-private partnership and all that. And I think that's what does need to happen. But, you know, it's not about paying the losses when it happens. It's about preventing the losses or mitigating the losses before it happens.
Yeah.
And to me, I would rather see the industry pay a tax that went to a domestic, by-country loss mitigation or preparatory plan where you're buying the proper PPE, you're educating the people, you would have a reserve to go buy a bunch of tests, that you have the ability to do contract tracing, and you'd have an infrastructure to some degree that could get dollars to the policyholders quickly. And maybe we get paid for part of that, or maybe that's just your social good. I'm not convinced that on short notice, the industry could have processed all those claims anyway. We would need to build a system that could deliver those monies. So I don't think it should be optional. I think this is a governmental issue. This is a public service and public health issue and a public policy issue. And I think the private market should be involved in that, but it's very difficult for us to be involved in the risk transfer. If the US does it, and the UK does it, and your EU does it, and Asia Pac does it, and Latin America does it, I got it globally. How am I supposed to deal with that? It's a pandemic. You know, you can't look at these little solutions country by country because it's a global issue by definition.
Yeah. Right, fair enough. And just before we finish, a couple of final questions for you. One is obviously one thing that has kind of emerged during COVID-19 is this the growing movement against racial inequality. And when we look at the industry, I mean, it's sort of widely considered as a, you know, the industry does have a diversity issue. So as a CEO of a reinsurance company, I mean, what practical steps can companies take to address that diversity issue and try and foster change?
Well, you start with the fact that you have to admit you have a diversity issue and then attack it. And there are internal changes you can make around internships, pay, equality and opportunity, going back and being self-examined, self-critical, or get a third party around education of your employees and sharing stories and feelings, which are all valid things to do and stuff we've started. We have a diversity and inclusion committee, and we're down the path. And that's a good place to get organized for actions internally. But, you know, this really starts in, you know, corporations are made up of people, right? And we are a reflection of society. And really the issue is in the homes and the schools, right? Right. It's in our everyday environment. Corporate America is not the problem. It is the symptom of a greater problem. So in my opinion, corporate America needs to go outside its own walls. It's a good place to start. But you, at that point, you're trying to change behaviors that have already been formed. These are people who are older. And so we need to volunteer in communities. We need to give our time, not just our money. We need to support grassroots re-education, what's taught in public schools. You know, where can we provide better opportunity or assistance or make an impact outside the workplace? Because the workplace is a reflection of the people who come in. So, yes, we have more minorities in senior positions. That would certainly help.
Yeah.
Right? But you've got to get them into your company, and you've got to get them to that spot. We can help in that standpoint, but you really have to change the entire mentality outside the companies for everything to take hold inside the companies. We can lead by example to a degree, but I think a lot of that leadership should be more in the public domain as opposed just behind the four walls of the company.
Understood. And I mean, another issue for the industry is, of course, a generational talent challenge and attracting talent into organizations, which, you know, in itself could be part of that sort of grassroots change that you need in terms of diversity in the sector. So, I mean, what's as a company, how do you go about attracting young talents? And also, you know, what advice as you sort of look back over your career and how you entered the sector? I mean, how would you advise, you know, young people maybe considering a career in?
We tend to prefer to hire people already in the industry, you know, in the insurance industry, into reinsurance. Because reinsurance at the end of the day is a derivative of insurance. So we think you should understand the underlying asset at the end of the day, but that doesn't have to be the case. We generally, historically, have hired more towards the liberal arts area, you know, in terms of we do more than just crunch numbers. You're making deals, you're marketing, and you're dealing person to person. And these are typically relationships. That might have to change, right? If people aren't going to be, if this isn't as much of a personal relationship, you know, we might want to look closer at hiring more people right out of school with analytical skills to build within the company. As a, you know, I used to tell our employees a lot, and I still do to a large degree. The Economist used to run a great ad, said, "Would you want to sit next to you at dinner?" And, you know, meaning, you know, you should be a well-rounded, cultural, diverse person who's interesting to talk to, not a one-trick pony. We still prefer that type of talent. But maybe, you know, the world is turning into more one-trick ponies. You do your job and you stay focused on it and you're a specialist. There's a lot of reasons why I don't like that, but that might have to change if this, we're not going to be interacting face to face. If there's not much value in building that personal relationship, then maybe that skill set changes. As far as advice, you know, I think people, especially if you're younger, you're going to live to be 100 years old today. You know, if you're 20, 22 years old. You don't have to figure it out on day one. Take some risks, take some chances, go live in a different country, go live in a different state, take jobs that are outside your comfort zone. But the biggest piece of advice is don't ask for more until you've done something with what you've got. Right. So if you get something, make the most of it, say, look what I've done, please give me more. And I find too many times people are looking for the next job before they finish the job in front of them.
Well, thanks so much to Mike Sabner for participating. And thanks to you as well, our listeners, for listening in. We've got a great pipeline of podcasts, so do visit our website at www.theinsurer.com for further details and also to access more of our high-value content.